Next time, I'm going to stay across the street. That way I can walk downstairs to the airport diner.
Because that was dope.
The diner was great. I liked that place.
They made me wear a hat. Did you have to wear the fucking paper hat?
What? Did you work there? Did you walk in and they were like, look, an ethnic diner employee. Come to the back. No, they didn't fucking make me wear a hat.
No, I went with my cousin, her boyfriend, and Ella, my cousin's kid. And they said, they asked, like, have you guys been here before? Knowing damn well Heidi had been there before. And then Heidi points to me. She's like, this is her first time. So they like whip out this hat and they're like, you have to wear it. And I'm like, I'm not wearing that fucking hat. And like everyone at the table is like, you have to wear the hat. So I wore the fucking hat.
What did
the whole
it look
time.
Like?
It was like, I have a picture. Of course.
Was it like a milkman hat or like a 1950s?
No, it's like a diner. It's like a short order
Hat. The little white like service boy kind of hat.
The white service boy.
You know what?
That's a fucking hat.
That's charming. That's charming. It's a great diner.
This is the airport diner. Yeah, the soup, in Manchester, New Hampshire.
The Super 8 that I stayed at. I want to leave it a bad review because it was so grotty. It was just not a, it wasn't a high quality place, but I genuinely liked the people so much that I can't write anything negative about them. It felt like a hostel for adults.
No.
You just be kind of bumming around. There's just be people like when I came in, I think I told you guys the live show, like came in, had my stuff and was like, hey, I need to check in. And this lady who was sitting there was like, oh, we don't do check-ins till 2 o'clock, but you can leave the bag there if you like. And I go, okay. And I talked to this lady for 45 minutes and then I'm like, great. So like, can I get my, and she's like, oh, I don't work here. Like she just hung out there. Pam just hung out and was like the house mom. And like we would like run into each other when the fire alarm went off, which happened multiple times. And,
multiple times.
And I'm like, oh, hey, Pam, how are you? And she's like, yeah, pretty good. Watching Law and Order. Can't go wrong with Law and Order. And I'm like, Yeah, right, Pam.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
So you can't write anything negative about them, but you can slander them on your podcast.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I don't think people are listening to this podcast for hotel recommendations, though. I think they're going to go on hotels.com or whatever.
Well, and I think people know just not to book at Super 8s.
Yeah.
That's just a thing people do.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I said to Heaton. Super 8's a great name because it's also an optimistic view of how you're going to rate your stay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You're not going to shoot for 10.
No.
At the Super 8. The best you can hope for is, you know, it was a Super 8.
In retrospect, mm-hmm. This was a here we are 4. Here we are at this point in our lives. Here we are. It's a 4. Let's all just like, you know what? It's stale pizza, but it's pizza.
That was what that was. You left the Super 8 realizing I can spend more.
Yeah. Okay.
I make enough and I deserve it. I don't need to be at the Super 8.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Cause I've stayed there once previously. I forgot about
it. That one in Manchester.
So last time in Yeah, but I forgot. This was 4 years ago. So 4 years ago, I went.
You stayed at my place.
I did the latter two nights, not the first night.
Really?
So the first night, this was 4 years ago. I don't know. I'm new at this. And I flew in and like just drove around and all of the hotels were booked completely. And the only one that wasn't booked was the maybe you should kill yourself here.
No locals. Foreign suicides only.
Like where they you come in and they're like, by the way, you can't hang yourself from the seat like that level. And I did it for one night and then Justin was nice enough to let me stay on his futon in his hotel room. And which was a nice moment for me this trip going like, oh, I'm now at the point where I'm like 4 years ago, I had to stay on people's futons and things.
Now I can get a room at a whorehouse.
And by the end of it, I was like, maybe I'm above whorehouse level. I could just go to like a nice one. It's tax deductible, you know, so that next time, 4 years from now, I'm going to have a room that includes hangers that no one's ever shot themselves in.
Sounds like a plan.
Dare to dream. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Jen Briney.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the program, we'll be talking about Governor Greg Abbott and the border and the Supreme Court. We will also be talking about Gen Z's gender split, not only here in America, but also around the world. Heaton, you got sick in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
But you're doing well now.
Yeah. No, I'm fully recovered. But that was the sickest I've been in about a decade, including COVID. Like I got.
Did you test? I tested
multiple times. It wasn't COVID. Huh. It was something else. But I got in. I had hoped, because Justin and I left a little bit earlier than we thought we were going to. I had hoped that my niggling cough was a byproduct of the fact that we probably smoked 4 cigars each.
That was true.
Over the course of the
time. For whatever reason, the default for what do you want to do became cigar bar? Cigar bar.
If you're traveling and you want to meet local people, cigar bars are great.
They are.
Because you go in and people, they want to chat, right? And like, sometimes bars are like that, not always, but you can't just go into a diner and be like, hi, I'm a journalist. Can I inflict myself upon your table? People are talking to their family. So I was hoping it was that. By the time I got off the plane on Tuesday night, I had such horrible full body chills that I couldn't get warm, and I had to put my home at 78 degrees. Now I realize that there are people listening to this program that 78 degrees is probably great because.
Fast forward this part.
Skip
we've all heard that it. Stuff. We've heard it.
For me, 78 degrees is like someone should take heat into the hospital. Like I keep my home at 68 degrees during the day. But it was nice. I'm improved. That part's nice.
Yeah.
And I've a couple of days into it, I felt like it was like a preview of my 80s where I was like sharp, but kind of tired, but dating a 34-year-old. And so like I was like, all right, this is just a premonition of what my life's going to be in 40 years.
And you, Jen, obviously had to deal with illness with Joe's COVID during the Iowa time, but everybody is recovering. You never got sick?
No, I never got sick. I got the hell out of New Hampshire as fast as I possibly could. So I was always leaving quickly. But I came back and Joe, he's had fatigue issues. But other than that, he's been better. So he did his first run yesterday. But it was like a full 3 weeks of not exercising, and like brain fog. You know, he was taking naps in between phone calls. So
damn.
Yeah. So it's he's getting better, but COVID sucks, walloped. Man. Yeah, he really got it hard.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think everybody's kind of getting something. I also feel like part of it is for the non-COVID stuff, it's the final revenge of that lockdown year. Where nobody got the flu or got sick, like the rates of that plunged, and so now everybody's immune system is still catching up, and we're like getting hit with these new flu and respiratory virus variants that are just knocking people out. Because Brian's got what sounds like what I had in October, which was an RSV that just was nothing but phlegm. And I was coughing up phlegm long after I was sick. I was coughing up phlegm in the morning for months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like it took me into January for me to stop doing it every morning.
Ew.
Yeah. Gross.
Yeah.
Hella gross.
Yeah.
Let's get into our first topic. Greg Abbott was on the losing end of a 5-4 ruling by the Supreme Court, which allowed federal Border Patrol agents to resume cutting razor wire fence Texas installed along its border with Mexico. This fence was part of Texas Governor Abbott's efforts to deter migrants and asylum seekers from entering the United States. The Supreme Court's ruling represented a victory for the Biden administration, which has been in a legal tussle with the state of Texas over border control issues. Despite this ruling, tensions and conflicts have continued. The Texas National Guard and state troopers have persisted in rolling out concertina wire and limiting access to certain areas like Shelby Park in Eagle Pass, Texas, despite the Supreme Court vacating the lower court's decision that previously prevented Border Patrol agents from cutting said wire. The court's order did not provide detailed reasoning, but upheld the principle that that the Constitution assigns the federal government sole responsibility for border security. This decision was something that has become the latest front of a legal battle in the fight between Texas's Operation Lone Star, launched in 2021, and the federal government. Of course, the U.S. southern border has witnessed a record of at least 6.3 million migrant encounters at and between ports of entry since Joe Biden took office on January 2021, according to data from the Office of Homeland Security Statistics. That has resulted in more than 2.4 million migrants into the United States. Heaton, you are our judge whisperer.
Uh-huh.
As far as the law goes, who should be responsible for the southern border, the federal government or the state that it sits on?
I think as far as the law goes, it's pretty clear that that's the federal government and not the state that it sits on. The argument that Abbott can make that I think has some credence to it is not a legal one, but a just kind of practical one, which is the federal government is the decision maker, but Texas is the consequence holder. That the border is a situation that is controlled by the federal government, but it's not a situation where the outcome of it is being distributed throughout the country. I think there's something legitimate to that, where just from a basic infrastructure perspective, if tons of people are pooling around very specific places around the Texas border to where local infrastructure can't handle it, where law enforcement is being overwhelmed, I think Texas has a point for that. But from a legal perspective, as opposed to who controls the border, no, it's straight up the federal government, and it's not in real dispute by any light. This is something that the Constitution's clear on in terms of the Supremacy Clause, that immigration, because it's something that affects all of the states, is not something states get to make their own laws on. Kansas doesn't get to say, we're only going to let in X amount of immigrants this year to the state of Kansas, because no one state is in charge of immigration for a country that has an open market and open borders, as we do within the United States. So that's something that the Constitution's clear on. The interesting and I think fairly fallacious legal argument that Abbott has engaged in the last few days is that the Constitution under, I think it's Article 1, subsection 3, does say states can't declare war unless somebody declares war on them and the state has to react immediately. So theoretically, if like China or, I don't know, Cuba or something were to just beachhead in Texas, mm-hmm. and the federal government was getting its act together and the governor said, this is an immediate situation, I'm calling out the National Guard. The National Guard, despite the thing being national, is really the state militia of Texas, that in that situation, the Constitution does authorize states to react in a warfare scenario. So what the Abbott administration is saying is that this is a literal invasion of Texas by illegal immigrants coming in from other places, and therefore constitutionally enables Texas to be able to react in kind. And I think that's a bridge too far to say that a mass migration, however lamentable or however stressing that is on local plenty of good reasons for Texas to be mad, for locals to be concerned. I'm not disputing that, but from a legal perspective, saying this is a literal capital I invasion, that's too much. This is not a foreign state that is making a military operation on American soil. But that is the argument that was effectively pushed by the Abbott administration and was shut down by the Supreme Court.
So you agreed with the ruling?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the ruling was interesting too, though. I'm not read it, but I don't think they really issued a huge amount of explanation on it either. They just put an injunction and went, look, the state governments, like what happened there was Texas was rolling out concertina wire along the border. Again, full credit to Texas here, like the perspective of Texas and a good faith argument would be, look, the federal government is failing its obligations to uphold the border. We're dealing with the consequences. So we will put in our own barriers. We will put in our own supplementary borders, things like that. Not inherently problematic, although constitutionally questionable. What then became the flashpoint was that the concertina wire was keeping federal border agents from being able to get into the Rio Grande to get some migrants that were crossing who were drowning. And so that became a problem where the Texas fence operations were interfering with federal law enforcement's abilities to maintain the border. And so
the federal government's not doing their job while at the same time preventing the federal government from doing their job.
And then there was like a secondary thing as well. There's like a flotilla that like a kind of a floating blockade buoy that they put in. Again, under federal law, if it's a navigable river, that's something that states can't impede. States aren't allowed to put up anything that interferes with the flow of commerce or navigation on navigable rivers. And then that becomes interesting because Don Willett, who's a federal judge, comes in and goes, well, this particular part of the river is not actually used for navigation, and goes back and forth. But basically, my read on it is, yeah, the Supreme Court put an injunction in that went, look, you don't get to interfere with this. This is something that the federal government, whether it's being competent or not, maintains its preeminence over illegally.
Well, regardless of the law, Jen, what should happen? Should Texas have more ability to affect the border?
Well, I mean, your analysis of this, I think, is exactly right, that it needs to be the federal government, which means it kind of needs to be Congress that makes necessary changes here. And so I spent yesterday listening to three different hearings about the situation. But the one that took place yesterday in the House Judiciary Committee was about this situation in particular. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating to me as I'm watching this is I know that Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, is a member of the Republican Party. And yet I'm watching his party in Congress impeding any kind of progress towards changing what he wants. So it's like when I am listening to the Border Patrol agents and hearing them say, like, this is what the problem is. A big problem is they don't have enough Border Patrol agents. And you kind of need to fund the government in order to fund more Border Patrol agents to go to the southern border. So on the one hand, they're saying Biden's not doing what he can at the border, but they're not paying for more Border Patrol agents, which is what they've been told they've needed for at least, I mean, that hearing that I listened to was earlier this, or it was last year. So, I mean, they've been told this for months now. It was years ago that I watched a hearing where they said in order to not have so many people be caught and then released into the United States, you need to have more judges. So you can have judges right there on the border. Oh, we have this illegal, well, I don't want to call them illegal because a lot of these people are claiming asylum. So they actually are allowed to be here. And part of the problem is we have such a backlog of cases that they're letting people come into the United States legally. So even calling this illegal immigration isn't exactly true. They're legally allowed to come into the United States to wait for their trial, but the trial could be years from now. What do you do about that? You get more judges. That is not something the Republicans are doing as well. Senator James Lankford, Republican from Oklahoma, has been working in the Senate with Kristen Sinema and another Democrat, Chris Murphy. Mm-hmm. They've been working together on a deal, which would be obviously bipartisan. You have an independent, a Democrat, and he's the Republican. He has now been censured by his own party in Oklahoma for even sitting down and doing his job. So I'm watching this party saying, like, the federal government isn't doing anything, but it's your party that is standing in the way of progress here. So once again, like, my frustration with all of this is now with Congress.
Yeah.
Now, what do you mean,
this
now?
This has been a problem. The border has been a problem
for a really long time. Yeah. And so, like, there is an effort right now to do something, but Donald Trump is telling his
say, you know, that you have had a good rule of thumb that, you know, we should at least read what the deal is. We have no idea what the deal is. And Lankford has been out trying to play PR for it, but details that have leaked, we have no idea whether or not they're real.
We haven't seen the text,
but it's all just a gigantic Kabuki theater until we actually see what the solution
would be. But before we even see that bill, Donald Trump is telling people in the Republican Party not to vote for it. He hasn't seen it either. He doesn't know what's in it. And he is saying, don't vote for it because he wants to run on this issue. So I'm looking at the Republican Party in general, where you have Greg Abbott putting up these fences in the Rio Grande that are, you know, cutting children who are being dragged into this river, like, it's endangering people's lives. And at the same time, his own party is standing in the way of current progress. So I'm just very frustrated with the Republican Party in general. And then where we do have to blame Biden, I'm also looking at the big picture, like, where the hell are all these people coming from? Because the one thing that isn't bullshit here is that this is unprecedented in the numbers. Like, Obama was actually the best in this regard. The number of people coming over illegally danced around 500,000. Once Trump got into office right before COVID, it got up to 1 million. So Trump was actually worse on this than Obama, but then COVID happened. But Biden, dude, it's 2021 was 1.7 million, then 2.3 million, then 2.4 million. And this is a lot of people. That's not bullshit. And I'm asking, like, where the hell are these people coming from? Well, 62% of them are apparently coming from Latin America. 22% are Venezuelan. 18% are Cuban. 8% are Nicaraguan. And when I look at that, just like macro. Well,
hold on. Also, yes, Cuba also speaks Spanish, but you got to take the long way around to get from Cuba to
through Mexico,
the southern border of Mexico.
Yeah.
As somebody who watched a lot of Cuban immigration throughout his life, there's a shorter path. It's a more dangerous one over water, but usually they came through Florida.
Yeah. And so now they're coming through the southern border. But like the point I'm trying to make is there are so many people coming here from countries that their country's economy has been attacked by ours. We are economically declaring war and have been for years on Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. And so it's like here we are hurting these countries economically because we don't agree with the lack of free market policies by their government. And so the people are leaving because their economies are terrible and they're coming here. All of this is fucking connected. So I just feel like where the Biden administration could make a difference would be to remove some of the sanctions on those countries. There's a lot of bigger picture things that we could do that are not putting razor wire on the river. And those aren't being discussed as much as I would like.
We are so deep into this that I think even looking at these as the same problems are problematic. Like, should there be razor wire on the border? Well, we should be funneling people into ports of entry, if even just to process them legally. We should probably have some kind of deterrence to places that any kind of crossing would be illegal, because those people are not claiming asylum if they're not going to a port of entry where you can legally claim asylum. But also, we don't have enough judges. And also, the flow of people is unprecedented. We have never seen this level. You said 62% mm-hmm. From Latin America? Like, that means that close to, you know, half are not from Latin America, which, by the way, is where the border is. You know, it's from those countries. So we have a real problem, an actual problem on our hands that I don't think is... It very much does not slot into red versus blue. It does not. Mm. This is a multi-generational problem that we have fought on, I think, especially unhelpful lines. We fought on racial lines. We fought on political lines. And now we're in the situation where we are, where not only have we not solved legal immigration, or making a pathway cleaner or easier for people that we want in America to be able to get to America. But we have also, because we've refused to do that, conflated it and said, oh, okay, well, let's make sure that asylum seekers are able to get in easier. Not to say that these people should not have a right to claim asylum, but there's no doubt it's being abused right now.
Most of them don't actually have a right to claim asylum. It's exactly. Just, it's the easiest path to even having any time in the United States. So it's interesting because it's like we've made it so hard to come here legally that people are just looking at the paths available to them, and claiming asylum could get you 2 to 3 years inside the United States, which, you know, it's better than whatever the hell they're coming from before. And because we haven't properly set up E-Verify, they are able to find jobs here. So it's a whole systematic problem that we have.
And it's a problem that I do think has been exacerbated by the way we have talked about it politically. I think that this is, we have to look back in time and say that some of the people that were talking about this the earliest in the early 90s, the Pat Buchanans of the world, maybe we should look back at what was looked at as out and out racist speech then and say, well, hey, you know, maybe old Pat was onto something. Maybe there was a problem, a smaller problem that could have been fixed with smaller measures than the one right now, where we're getting into a constitutional crisis because the state that bears the brunt of this migration says that they want to have some kind of say in it.
I think there are three different camps there. And part of it is that one of them is like a shadow camp. So group one, immigration is great. I'm not that worried about it. So group one is like, let's increase immigration and also have some border stops to make sure nobody's bringing in guns, but otherwise we're not too worried about it. So kind of the way we have it at Canada right now, where people really aren't worried about the Canadian border, right? Group two, immigration is great, but we want to have very secure borders. So these are folks that want immigration to come in. America's a nation of immigrants. Immigration is good for the economy. But we want to make sure that it's the people that are coming in at the southern border aren't coming in as part of drug trafficking, aren't human trafficking, aren't bringing in disease or crime, et cetera, et cetera. And then group three doesn't want immigration, but doesn't want to say it out loud. And so pretends to be in group two. And that to me is part of the nexus of the problem here is that I respect, like, I'm probably more in the former camp. I'm not worried about the Canadian border. And I think that the problems that are coming in through the border are largely a result of the drug war and a few other things. And those are the things that I would tackle head on. And then just if you want to come in and pick fruit in the United States, thanks for coming. Strong back. We can use you. Great. The problem that I see is the legitimate position of yay immigration, but let's make sure it's good people coming in is getting conflated also with an additional group of we just don't want immigrants. And then that ends up creating this kind of morass that's difficult to work through. And then you add that to the fact that I'm not confident either party really wants to sort this out because it ends up being a good political football that they can use. Like Jen, you brought up a minute ago, Trump doesn't want to get this resolved before the 2024 election. I think that that's accurate. I think he'd like it to stay bloody and angry and chaotic because he can then be the law enforcement Republican that comes in and fixes it. And then conversely, on the Democratic side, like I noticed that
part of why Biden got elected was reversing Trump's racist border policies. That was a talking point. That was a day one thing that Joe Biden did was reverse Donald Trump's border policies. Right. Reverse Remain in Mexico. He lifted Title 42. Like these were
well, he wanted to keep Title 42. So, I mean, the courts made him overturn that. But I think you're both onto something here where it's, I mean, I know I grew up in Southern California, so not exactly on the border in Orange County, but not far from it. And I remember in the 1990s having to listen to conservative talk radio to and from school every day. And they were constantly telling me that the illegal immigrants were what's fucking up everything. And yet, in my experience, they were the gardeners, the nannies, the cooks. They were always kind. I had no problems with them whatsoever. And so I was like personally offended just being like, you're being so mean. Like these people are just here to work and they've done nothing awful. And yet you're calling them terrorists. And I heard something very similar in these hearings I listened to yesterday. The word invasion fucking kills me because it implies that these people that are coming to our border are all terrorists and they're all, you know, here to hurt us and they're bringing guns and fentanyl and weapons. It's bullshit. There has not been a single terrorist attack that has been perpetrated in the United States because of someone who came over the southern border. 18 out of the 19 hijackers were here on tourist visas. So it's not like, yeah. And like, while it could happen, this is not something that has happened in reality. When it comes to fentanyl, that is one of the Republicans' biggest bullshit talking points because the vast majority of the fentanyl that gets into the United States illegally is coming through American citizens going through our actual ports of entry. We're talking like more than 99% is coming through legal ports of entry. So it's like, when you listen to the Republicans talk about this and you know they're spewing bullshit, it makes it really hard to then have a conversation with people on that side when you're like, you're not even dealing with reality. You are demonizing these migrants. You're saying that poor people are the source of so many of our problems when it's just not true. So it even with me, like I know that everything that you're saying that this is a problem for red, blue, like all of us, it's a problem to have this many people coming to our border and like not knowing what to do with them. I am inclined to dismiss it just because there's so much bullshit on that side of the conversation.
And I think that's the reason why we haven't gotten anything done.
Yeah.
To be honest, is because there is a reflexive element of if a conservative is talking about the border, they're racist and wrong.
But they're also saying things that are actually wrong. Like legit provably wrong. And then they will be told by experts this is wrong. And then the next Republican will get up and say the wrong thing over and over again.
To the terrorist point, I forget who from the FBI just testified before Congress about a month ago and said that all lights were flashing largely because of the unchecked influx at the border in terms of domestic terror threats.
Yeah, I mean,
there are more than just Republican rabble rousers saying that that is a point of concern because we just don't know. I think there have been people on the terror watch list that have been apprehended trying to cross the border. So it is not just a total empty.
But the idea, even like we're talking about these numbers, these people that are coming over the border are either giving themselves up. Most of them are giving themselves up saying like, oh, I don't know where the port of entry is, but like I'm claiming asylum. So we have a lot of those people and we don't have a ton of people that are getting through
and not ever getting caught. That's like, we have a lot of people arriving. We don't have a lot of people that are just getting in and then are fancy free in the United States.
I mean, except for the tenderloin.
Well, I don't know what you mean by that.
The fentanyl trade that comes, you know, to San Francisco in the tenderloin.
Well, again, like I said, when you watch the hearings about fentanyl, we are being told that it is American citizens that are getting paid to bring it in.
It's the manpower. Yeah. The manpower that is
coming here.
Okay. I think part of the reason that this is such a perennial issue and a emphatic issue for conservatives is I think that this really activates the conservative heuristic. So we've talked on this program previously that like the progressive lens is oppressor versus victim. Watch anything on MSNBC. Every story could be subtitled, Big Guy Stomps on Little Guy. That's the progressive worldview. The conservative worldview is civilization under threat. That's always like, that could be the subtitle on every single Fox News story. It could be civilization in peril. That's how, that's the conservatives think, is that civilization is delicate and it's under threat, right? So conservatives look at the border, and this is something that just automatically activates that smoke alarm for them because it's other. It's capital O other coming into the United States. And I think that's part of why this becomes such a like such a big issue for conservatives, is it's something that really hits a live wire for them. In terms of like how to fix it, I think that it's doable. I the thing that surprises me about this is that we haven't figured out that we could probably just spend our way out of this. So like the conservatives want to build a big wall along the border, right? My hero PJ O'Rourke described that as a $1 billion subsidy to Mexican ladder companies, and I'm inclined to agree with him. But giving them their due, they want to have a speed bump that slows immigration down long enough to allow people to allow federal authorities to accurately gauge and
catch them
to catch them and just legally process them, right? So like making a good faith argument. High walls, wide gates, right? And like, I'm fine with that. Like, if we wanted to just spend more money on a border, and as a result, we were able to, like, you know, and also increase money on border agents and judges, as Jen points out, it's going to be more expensive. But if that allows us to deal with the situation and move on and have legal immigration occur, great. I think there's another part to that, though,
financially, that I heard from the witnesses that were actually trying to solve the problem, they were talking about how hard we make it for people to work. So if you do have people coming into the country, like I'm halfway through reading HR 2. I think I am bringing back Congressional Dish this month to tell people like this is what the Republicans actually want. And one of the things that I've noticed is they want to make it extremely hard for someone who is a migrant who is here legally to work right when they get here, which means that they have to use our healthcare system. They have to use our welfare. They have to use our shelters because they're not allowed to earn money on their own. And so in these hearings, they're saying like, we have to have a much easier path for work, which in which case, like those people get taxes and they become a part of like a productive part of our society. In which case, like when you have them getting taxed and actually working and producing things, that does help to pay for the border patrol and the walls and like all that.
I'm in agreement with you.
Letting them work is key. And the Republicans are doing the exact opposite. They want to make life so miserable for them that the word gets out that like, just don't come here because it's miserable and it's awful. And like, that's their plan for dealing with it. They want to make it hard.
Although I do want to give some credit to the Republicans in that you go back to, granted, this is now years and years ago, but like Reagan versus Bush Sr., you watch the Republican primaries. Reagan and Bush were arguing about who was more pro-immigrant and who was trying to bring in more people from Mexico. George W. Bush was the last attempt the government's actually made at any point to overhaul
comprehensive immigration.
And what Bush wanted to do, and he was right, was make it easier for people to work, was for them to come over and get a guest worker pass and figure out a way for people to have a legal status to work in the United States, which is what we should have.
He had a Hispanic nanny that he loved and like talked to her about this and was trying to, it's one of the places where he actually was a compassionate person, but he was like, this was way too hard for her to get a work permit, wanted to do something about it, and didn't happen. So,
I agree. A big part of the problem is figuring out how are we going to not what happens at the border, but what is the work situation we're coming inside? That's a big part of it. I do think that there's a way to make a deal here in that I think Republicans are extremely obstructionary when it comes to immigration. I agree. To give a little bit of flack to the Democrats, I noticed that the Dreamers only ever get brought up when it's politically advantageous. And then when they're no longer used as a bludgeon to make Republicans racist, they just kind of disappear. They're no longer a talking point. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know. How about like more
border? What happened to those kids in cages?
Well, I can answer that one. The kids in cages one is a rhetorical flourish, depending on who's racist or not. So gotcha. The kids in cages started under Obama for good reason, which is when you had people coming in across the border that were getting detained. For good reason, the American federal government went, we're not going to put a bunch of kids in a room with random dudes they don't know. That strikes us as a really bad opportunity for things to happen, of just having a bunch of strangers in a room at night with inadequate supervision and children. We're not going to do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to separate the men from the women and the children to ensure that nobody's getting diddled while they're on American soil. And we're going to put a cyclone fence there. That way, if your dad is over on the other side, he can come talk to you. That started under the Obama administration. And then when Trump came in, that became putting kids in cages because the Republicans are evil monsters. But when the Democrats do the same thing, it's just a keen way to do it. So that's a rhetorical flourish. But I don't know.
The conditions when Trump was doing it were far worse. I mean, he was separating people that were children from their actual parents. I mean, it was worse the way that it was done. It was, again, used as a way to say, like, it's so awful there. Don't come to America. It was more punitive. So
sure.
That's part of the,
sure. Okay.
The outrage. But you're right that, like, there's still migrant kids in, this is another part we never bring up, private fucking prisons. So a lot of people are making a lot of money by having these people that are caged for merely coming over an invisible line. Like, that is a problem.
I can only imagine the government outlay for hotels and, like, there's, like, infrastructure. Like, airports, because now this is a conservative media red meat thing where anytime that anybody is a hotel or a school or an airport that is being used to house migrants, it's, you know, captured on video and it goes worldwide. But just looking at it as a dollars and cents thing, that stuff isn't happening for free. The government's paying something to these places to have that happen. Yeah. You got to imagine, right?
For sure.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, I think you could, I'm surprised nobody struck a deal here yet of like, hey, why don't we naturalize dreamers and build this stretch of wall? Republicans, you get more wall. Democrats, you get dreamers. Like,
That was a Trump pitch.
Yeah.
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 That was a Trump pitch before the shutdown, before back around Labor Day of got to be 17 or 18.
Well, and that was also back when any stretch of wall suddenly became a racist monolith,
yes.
Right? So like there was a period where
his racist wall.
Pre-Trump, it was a question of how much wall do we want? Like, yeah. Hillary Clinton had voted in the Senate to increase the wall. Nancy Pelosi increased the wall and so forth. I thought Trump was doing way too much wall because there were parts of it that were just unnecessary. But it
went, and writing racial slurs on it himself, I think, yeah. Making it more racist.
But then the wall became, if you could just push a button and it would make a wall magically go across the southern border and it didn't cost anything.
A gold wall that says Trump?
Sure. If it was free, if I could hit a button and it would freely, like, my thing was just cost, like, benefit analysis.
Like,
but it went from cost benefit analysis to this is a racist wall, right? Then it became a fight on that. And we couldn't do any type of negotiating there.
They're rapists. Some are good people. I mean, he did say some pretty racist shit. I do think that part of Trump's, you know, focus on the wall and the border does have to do with he just doesn't like poor brown people all that much. And I think that's another reason why people are just kind of, they want to stay away from this issue. Yeah, I mean, but it also, like, when you look at why don't progressives care more about this or Democrats or whatever, it's because there is
cities where they don't have to deal with it.
No, that's not true. Southern California, are you kidding me?
Well, that's the level of delusion in Southern California has afforded the ability to live amongst a lot of things.
It's not delusion. It's the fact that I've lived amongst illegals my entire life and they've caused absolutely no problems whatsoever. In fact, they work very hard. You can go to Home Depot, hire people to do stuff in your homes. They're kind and they work hard and they'll work for pizza and they haven't been a problem in our society, and therefore that's one of the reasons that Southern California isn't all that upset about it, because they haven't hurt any of us. So and that's also like when I just, there's an ick factor to when certain people talk about immigration.
Yeah, you don't really trust conservatives on this issue.
Some of them.
You don't believe that they are.
I think James Langford
you don't believe that they are a good faith bargainer on this issue, because
it depends on who we're talking
they
about.
They are liars and racists.
That's not what I said.
Okay.
You're trying to needle me. No, James Langford right now, I believe, is absolutely negotiating in good faith. I think Mitt Romney has negotiated on this in good faith. We just talked about George W. Bush. I think he had ideas that on this in good faith. Donald Trump, I don't think is on that list. And so that's why when I'm watching people take direction from him, being told to tank a deal they haven't even said yet that I do think is being negotiated in good faith in the Senate. And there are people in the House, including the Speaker of the House, indicating that he's down with the idea to tank this for political reasons for Trump. That is a giant problem. And those are the type of people I don't trust, because it seems like they want this somewhat
that may be what is going to happen. That is not what they're saying. They're saying it's a bad deal. They know it's a bad deal. And so it's dead in the water.
Yeah, that's called bullshit.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, but let's at least say what they are saying.
My read is about half the Republicans want legal immigration and secure borders, and about half the Republicans don't want immigration. And part of the problem for me is that these are not clearly defined camps within the Republican Party, and that a lot of the people that don't want immigration are going, yeah, I want immigration. I want a secure border, right? There's a good faith and a bad faith argument, right? Like there's a bunch of Democrats who want legal immigration and, like Jen says, like see all the benefits of legal immigration. There's another group of Democrats that go, we can use this as a bludgeon to make people look racist, right? There's good faith and bad faith argument sides to this.
Yeah.
On the Republican side, again, it seems to me about half the people in the Republican Party want legal immigration and a secure border, and the other half don't want legal immigration and want to erect problems.
What is, by polling, real is that this issue has moved from a solidly Republican issue to something for which not only affects independents, but also Democrats. If you look at the polling numbers of Democrats who are in favor of deportation, not just stronger border stuff, but ejecting people that are here, that has moved by like 10 or 15 percentage points since Biden came into office.
Well, that's another interesting thing is the Republicans keep saying that Biden's not doing anything. And yet since May, so let me give you some numbers. Obama was known as the deporter in chief, pissed off a lot of progressives.
By progressives.
He deported, on average, every year he was president, 344,000 people. Trump only deported 234,000 people. Now, Biden, when Title 42 was in place, it was a lot lower. But since May of this year, he has deported 470,000 people. So the idea that he's doing nothing and not deporting anyone is total horseshit.
Since May of 2023.
Yes. Less than a year, 470,000 people. So the deportations are happening, and yet that's not being told.
I would wonder what that, I can't do the math in my head percentage-wise compared to the people that came in, but I would wonder if percentage-wise that is, if you add everything up.
So here's the problem with not funding the government and not increasing the funding for these things. ICE can only do so many of these. So the fact that they're even doing that without an increase in their budget is pretty good. If you want more deportations, you need more ICE agents, and those have not been funded at all in this Congress. So they can't just magically get more staff.
So do you think that the border is better under Biden than Trump?
I mean, I don't think that we can blame Biden except for, you know, sanctioning Venezuela, continuing all that stuff. But like,
but that's long-standing American policy.
Yes, exactly.
So we're going to call
that a wash because Trump started Venezuela. We call that a wash.
Yeah.
The fact that there's more people coming to the border,
you
can't really blame that on him. You can only blame on him, like his reaction to it. And what I'm seeing is more deportations. I'm seeing them begging for more judges and border patrol agents and ICE agents and not getting it from Congress, in large part due to Republican obstruction on the government funding. We're now halfway into the fiscal year ended on September 30th. There's no chance of the government being funded before March 1st. So we're going to be best case scenario.
They did have both chambers and the presidency until the midterms, right?
Sure. But if you're the Republicans screaming about this, like
past the midterms
right now.
Okay.
We are in this Congress for the last year and a half and they have not increased Border Patrol, ICE, judges.
Yeah.
That stuff's not happening. That has to be done in Congress.
Yeah.
And the House of Representatives has been a total roadblock to government funding, which is where increases in funding would happen because they want nothing but cuts. So that's a problem. If you're saying that we need to have more Border Patrol agents, if you need the law enforcement to have the staff that it needs to do the things that you want and yet you don't want to fund it, I don't know what the fuck to do in those negotiations. If you're saying that you have to cut federal law enforcement and yet increase federal law enforcement, that's a problem. So I don't know how much I can blame Biden here when he's saying, I need more staff, I need more money because we have more people coming, and he's not getting the stuff that he needs from Congress.
So, yes, question mark. It's better under Biden than Trump.
Well, no, the situation is clearly worse, but it's because we have more people coming.
Yes.
So I don't like and to frame this as Biden or Trump. You don't because think that that was a different that situation. That
was egged on in any way by Biden? Because that's another argument that's made.
Is that him? Egged on?
Yeah, that him reversing the policies that Trump had was and rhetoric leading up to his election.
You know, that's a really weird one too, because Title 42, Biden did want to keep it, but because it was a COVID era thing, he wasn't legally allowed to. So
that was after it got messy, though. That was years into his term.
Regardless, it got
over. We're talking about the stuff that he signed on day one, like Remain in Mexico.
It got overturned, Title 42, yeah, which is nicknamed for Remain in Mexico, in May of 2023. And since then, he has deported 470,000 people.
No. Remain in Mexico, he reversed on day one of his presidency. Title 42 was a different thing. Remain in Mexico was put in before COVID by Trump.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know. All I know is that it's not his fault that there's more people showing up at the border and he doesn't have the resources that he needs. So to compare Trump versus Biden when they had completely different situations, I don't know how to make that comparison.
So this surge.
Trump never dealt with this.
Yes. And this surge was just that is a happenstance of other things that are outside of the purview of the American president.
I mean, I don't know how he can control migrants in other countries.
Okay.
So.
Heaton, anything else?
No, I think you got it. Thanks, gang.
Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. This will go, we will be talking about Taylor Swift.
I'm so excited.
Oh, boy. So am I. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. Thank you guys so much for keeping us up on that because, you know, we did these two shows and, you know, we didn't sell tickets. So we are out there meeting the people. The best that we can, but it happens because you guys support us. It makes doing this show worth it. So
your support
there right now
afforded a whorehouse for Andrew Heaton.
Yeah,
and I didn't even avail myself to it. All I did was microwave pizza in the whorehouse's kitchen. I, you know, in retrospect, what a missed opportunity for shenanigans.
You didn't ask Pam for a rate card.
Pam was like a cool neighbor lady. That was our relationship. We weren't knocking boots.
Yeah, you have a whorehouse. I was in a basement. But Justin Robert Young, you got a real hotel.
I did.
You got all fancy.
My hotel had a yoga ball in it. It was like a workout hotel. It had
just had a yoga ball
cables and it had a lot of space. Like you could actually like work out, and it was like a hardwood floor inside the hotel. The Even Hotel.
Nice.
It's a and then their gym was awesome. 24-hour gym, and it had a programmable treadmill so you could do high intensity workouts.
In mind, they had duct taped a pillow to the wall and put a sticky note that said punching bag on it. And that was the gym. If you wanted to go hit the punching pillow, you could.
Yeah.
So we're living large on your dime is what I'm saying.
Big time. Research reveals a significant ideological divergence between young men and women of Generation Z, challenging the notion that a generation shares similar political and ideological views. Alice Evans, a visiting fellow at Stanford University, highlights this greater gender divergence within Gen Z, with young women leaning toward progressive ideologies while their male counterparts show a conservative inclination. This phenomenon is not limited to one region, but is rather a global trend, evident in countries across other continents. So in the United States, for instance, Gallup data indicates a 30% difference between liberal views between women and men aged 18 to 30, a gap that has emerged in just over 6 years. I wonder what happened then. Similar trends are observed in Germany, the UK, and Poland, with notable disparities in political affiliations between young men and women. The divergence is even more pronounced outside the West, in countries like South Korea, China, and Tunisia, showing stark ideological splits amongst the younger generation. The Me Too movement is identified as a significant catalyst, particularly influencing young women's feminist values and political stances. Jen, you're a woman. Beyond why this trend is happening, how do we think it will affect society moving forward?
Jen, you're the token vagina on the panel. Let's throw this.
We found one of you on the internet. Let's let's ask you questions.
Justin and I were talking. We're like, women are all the same, right? Of course, of course, old boy. Well, what if we got one of these women on the show to talk about vaginal issues that you know represent the monolithic opinions of the weaker sex?
By the way,
the Taylor Swift pitch was not mine.
No, that was mine. As often happens on the show with the Taylor Swift pitch, it was me going, "The fuck is happening? Can you all explain this to me?"
And I'm like, "Me, I know all of it." So,
and then all the research I did on the death of journalism just flew out the window because we're going to talk about Taylor Swift.
It'll keep dying. It'll come up again. Don't worry.
You'll get to.
I don't think it's going to suddenly write and everybody's going to be like, you know what's really flourishing? Local journalism. Why that really turned around.
National journalism, too. Don't make me do the topic. Jen, speak for all women.
Oh, I don't understand kids these days. I do think the Me Too movement obviously had to have a big effect. And I think that watching the shining city on a hill go backwards horrifically when it comes to women's rights and women's issues and, you know, bringing back coat hanger abortions. And I am not surprised that the younger women are absolutely shocked by this and flocking towards, you know, the ideological part of the spectrum that had to fight for women's rights. And now all of a sudden we're going to have to fight for them all over again. And the way that our information here in the United States, I mean, we're all pretty well traveled. It goes all over the world. So I think in a lot of ways what happens in the United States feels like it's global. So I'm...
Why is everyone so obsessed with us?
Because we are obsessed with us. We act like there's no other parts of the world. But
But they prove it.
I know. I know. It's funny going overseas and seeing how Americentric the news really is.
Well, it's funny because like in America, back in when we had television news broadcast, there'd be 15 minutes that covered the rest of the world. Yeah. It'd be all about America, and then 15 minutes that covers the rest of the world. When you go to the rest of the world, their news has 15 minutes that's just about America.
Yeah.
Like that's it. We do have that asymmetric relationship.
Yeah. I turned on BBC World the other day. No, it wasn't the other day. It was a couple weeks ago. It was right after the New Hampshire primary because there was some shit that went down in Gaza that I wanted to know about. And after a half hour of nonstop speculation about Donald Trump and Nikki Haley, I was like, oh, this is as bad as ours. I need to move on because I'm not going to get actual news here. But I think that does have an effect on the entire world, that when people see America going backwards and we're supposed to be, you know, the arsenal of democracy or whatever, and like other countries are supposed to look to us for hope, to watch women going backwards here has to be demoralizing. And I'm not young, but if I still had 20, 30 years of reproductive years left in my old ass uterus, if I still
that old jalopy,
if this thing wasn't falling apart
just
on its
bolts
own,
and cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
If it wasn't geriatric, if I still had 20, 30 years left of having to worry about getting pregnant and not wanting to be, I'd be pretty progressive and active in it too. So yeah, I think,
but this was before the Roe versus Wade overturn.
I mean, this was Me Too. Yeah, it starts with Me Too.
Which was a moment of female empowerment, right?
Empowerment, but also education. Because a lot of people felt like they were alone in different, you know, sexual assault situations that we didn't quite realize were sexual assaults. Like, oh, like he just put in the tip, it's fine. It's like, no, that was not allowed. but there was a lot of women that had things happen to them and then went, oh, shit, like that wasn't cool. I didn't realize that wasn't just something that happened to me. It happened this often. So I think a lot of women felt, and I felt this way where it was like, oh, like this is far more rampant than I thought it was. These things that I just kind of brushed off weren't cool. And so I think it brought an awareness. And then in the wake of that, to see things get worse for us instead of better in some ways, I think the younger generations are probably freaked out by that, because even as an old, I'm freaked out by that. And I'm not surprised that they're more progressive and active in that sphere. And I hope that leads to something good. I hope that leads to women voting in a way in all of their different countries for more rights. I hope it leads to more activism, because I'm concerned by what I'm seeing. So I'm not surprised, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Heaton, what's with these women?
Why
do women be so crazy?
Yeah. Rant about them bitches.
Why bitches be so crazy? I have a very different analysis on this. I think we are in this conversation so far playing way too much of an emphasis on the role of America and the idea that everyone in the entire world is becoming more progressive or less progressive based on their reaction to American politics. I think that is giving so much intellectual credit to what's happening in the United States is to miss the mark. What I think is going on is we've got globally a technological shift that shattered monolithic culture in a way that is new. And you're like any time we see big shifts like this that happen globally rather than in the United States, that's a sign that something's happening that's not specific to the United States, right? So if it's something just happening in America and it's not happening in Europe, maybe there's some quirk of the American electoral system or the American economy that's leading to that outcome. But if it's happening in Europe and it's happening in South Korea and it's happening in Japan, that to me says that there's something systemic going on outside of the American situation. So I look at these numbers that are happening in the aforementioned countries. And what I see going on is previously you are growing up and you are getting the same news media as all of the men and women in your generation. You're all getting the same basic Overton window of information and you're playing around in that shared reality. That shared reality has been collapsed by the internet. It doesn't exist anymore. We now live in a world where you go on Instagram and what are you going to get? Stuff that's tailored to you. If you're a teenager now in South Korea or in Jowls County, Montana, either way, the information you're getting is tailored to you algorithmically based on your interests. And so what you're seeing is rather than having men and women having a similar worldview that they're living in, you're now having it being very, very atomized along gender roles based on this technological slant. So I think that's happening. But the immediate takeaway I have is, wow, I'm glad I'm not 18 and dealing with this shit. Like I feel like my generation got really slammed by online dating, which I think in retrospect was a really bad move. I think online dating's been mostly bad. At least the people that I've been going on dates with have had like a broadly shared reality to me. I can't fathom how difficult dating's going to be for this upcoming generation where, 30-point spread or something like that? 30 points? Like if you now have a thing where incoming generation is women are overwhelmingly progressive and men are overwhelmingly conservative. That is going to be some difficult dating for the incoming people. I do not relish the situation that they're about to get into. And I suspect that is broadly epistemological and it's broadly a decentralized.
And by the way, we're on the lower end compared to places like South Korea.
Yeah.
Like South Korea and China and Tunisia, the splits are even larger.
Yeah. Although I will quibble a little bit in that I do get when I see broad reports like that and they go conservative or progressive. What is conservative and progressive in a South Korean context compared to America? I don't believe there's some essentialist cosmic blue team, cosmic red team that, you know, manifests as one of two options across the time space continuum. I think that that's just drivel and nonsense, right? So I do question what that means. But if we take it at face value that there's a conservative party and a progressive party in each of these countries except China, and the men are more attracted to, I don't know what conservative means in this context. But the fact that there is going to be this political shift and political difference between the two genders, I do not think will be fun for the people in it as they're growing up.
I do think that and I would broadly assign this as a global phenomenon. Number one, you totally took my point. It's the internet. Spoiler alert. Everything.
But what are they seeing on the internet?
Whatever they want to see.
But this is where I think like I think you're right. It's a yes and situation. But I think what the women are seeing are more stories about what other women are going through. I think it's more stories. I think
I would agree with you on the Me Too thing. Because America has a very liberal society and it has, relative to other countries, a society that has had feminist influence in our culture in the past. I think if you are in South Korea and you're looking at the Harvey Weinstein thing, you're like, oh, that's bad in America? Like, holy shit. Like, there's a lot of stuff in a far more misogynistic and hierarchical cultures like they have in other parts of the world. Then, yeah, if the Me Too stuff is lighting America on fire, then all of a sudden you look at your situation, you're like, oh, my God, wait a minute. There's a lot more that I need to think about. But in general, I don't know how much people in Poland are following Roe. I don't know because in a lot of these Western European countries, they've had a far different road when it's come to abortion.
Well, they all did it legislatively. We did it judicially.
And also they have more homogenous religious cultures than America has, which is a tremendous patchwork of a jillion different cultures. Right. So I don't know if it's one-to-one American politics that's lighting this stuff on fire, but I do think that
I didn't mean to say that it was all American politics. I do think that we have an outsized influence on the media and the internet.
Well, we invented it, but
the Me Too stuff is kind of universal because it was all women, like you said, like in other countries can look and like compare to your own situation. So it's not just a country thing. It's a whole worldwide. Be like, this is what other women are going through. This is fucking nuts. I thought that
if you're in China, you're like, but wait, they also got to be famous when they fucked Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. Like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like this. Like, I got abused for way less.
No, exactly. I think that's a part of it. And then when it comes to like, I don't know. I forgot what I was saying. You distract me. It's gone.
I do think that worldwide we have far more gender-based conversations than I can remember growing up. And not just in terms of, women's reproductive health or the role of masculinity or men or anything in society, but also in terms of sexuality and the fact that our conversation about gay and queer Americans has now become outsizedly dominated by conversation about trans Americans, which for regardless of where you stand on the issue, the fact that we have now larger conversations about what is gender? How does one define a gender? Can you switch genders? What is the spectrum of genders? There's a lot of focus and fascination on it, which means people are going to find themselves somewhere and then dig in. I think that's the nature of instability is finding stability. And if that means that, okay, well, now I want to essentialize myself as a man or a woman, it seems to me to be a consequence of a lot of conversations that we've had about gender in general.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I was going to the airport in Southeast Asia, flying back to the States. And I don't remember where I was, Thailand maybe. And I carpooled with a Chinese fellow that was staying at my hotel in a tuk-tuk. So we just shared the cab on the way to the airport. And I'm being folksy and chatty and everything. And he spoke English, thankfully. So, you know, making friends and all that. And I'm talking to him and I went, hey, so if you could switch genders for some limited amount of time, how long would you do it? I'd do it for half a year. I think maybe 6 months would be a good period to, you know, kind of really wallow in being
this
a woman for a
driver.
While. No, this isn't the driver. This is just the Chinese fellow that I'm sitting in the back with.
Oh, okay.
And he took a deep breath and he went, I think your country is just more interested in novelty than my country. I don't really care. And that was he couldn't care. I was like, you wouldn't want to switch genders at all for like a week. And he's like, not in the slightest. I don't want to be a woman. I don't want to know what it's like. This does not appeal to me, nor does the conversation. And I was like, oh, okay. And he was an otherwise nice guy, but it did kind of touch on me like, yeah, I think America does care about this.
Did you try to caress his thigh right after that?
Yeah.
Was that your opener?
I was like, hey, we're both gay, right? And touched his penis and he.
Tuk-tuks with Heaton.
Yeah.
Always an adventure.
But I do think we talk about gender a lot more. And I think there's all sorts of things that America could be better about in terms of how women have it and everything that goes along with that. And I think a lot of other countries are far, far worse based on when I travel around. I don't know. I think it's a spectrum. And we tend to always look at just what is Northern Europe doing? And we don't look at like Northern Africa, which I think is very different in terms of their approach towards gender.
But the fact that this is global, and like you said, like social media is global, you could see women in, you know, Africa feeling a kinship now with people in North America and just being like, oh, like they get it too. Like just a kinship with everyone. And
what are these rich women up to?
It's not, it's just women. I don't know. You guys don't get it. Like you don't get harassed. Don't
bunch of dudes shitting it up.
Like, have you guys ever waited tables or had a retail job?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How many times have you had your ass grabbed?
By staff?
By random customers?
I'm sorry, if there was some, if there was some staff, confusion, but, I'm not
happened to me by staff.
I'm not claiming, to be very clear, that I'm not claiming that there's not sexism going on in the United States. That is not the claim that I'm making.
Yeah,
in any way,
me
shape,
either.
all I'm saying is that when we're looking at the factors of what's causing this, the internet and the atomization of information is the dominant factor. That's the top one. That's what I'm saying.
But I think it matters what that information is.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that information is exposing women around the world have more in common than we think.
I do think that, especially in places like Northern Africa or other countries that don't have the same GDP, they do look at Americans as being rich, if not privileged.
Sure. And so then to see themselves in our stories on TikTok and like vice versa, I think it's probably a uniting thing. And so if you see women starting to, when you do a poll, but also like you said, like what the fuck are they measuring? Like what does progressive mean? But if you see women around the world starting to see things more closely, more ideologically homogenous, if you will, around the world, that makes some sense to me. Because we see more kinship in each other despite our differences, despite our skin color and our socioeconomic backgrounds and all of that. I think that has to be a reason why globally this is happening. And it's not just in the US and Northern Europe.
Last question on this topic. Let's assume that this is real and replicable. Is this a bad trend to have such stark political divides on gender lines?
I don't think so.
I think, yeah. I mean, if
the only single one is like, Jesus. More?
I mean, like, look, if there are bad things happening, and historically speaking, the most oppressed group of people in human history is women. Like, for those of us that love liberty, and I'm one of them, the greatest freedom fighters in the history of humankind have been women and feminists, because the group that gets shit on in every single culture, every single place in the world, is always women. Women always have the worst end of the stick, right? So if there is oppression going on, if there is sexism going on, if there's something that is problematic for people and they happen to be women, that's not something that I want to have where one group goes, it's a problem, the other group says it's not a problem. That does not strike me as a good thing. I want, like, if there's a problem, I want society to know it and deal with it and move it. So I want men to be aware of it if there is a problem, and rather than having like a gendered political thing, the idea that like parties would become gendered is terrifying to me. I do not think that that would be helpful. I think the amount of intransigence we have right now in the government, where we have so much gridlock going on, like imagine now it's also the men and women versus each other. That does not strike me as a situation where you're going to get a lot of consensus and you're going to get a lot of ability to make change. So I don't think it's a good idea to have like heavily gendered political views that cohere.
I don't know. I guess I'm not that afraid of disagreement. I also don't know what the fuck this poll was measuring. So it's really hard to say, like,
people,
but like, what are your progressive, like, what does it mean for a man to be conservative and a woman to be progressive? Like, I don't really know what they're measuring.
Yeah. That is a fair point. Cause like you start like, there's a term called essentialism, and this is this great mythology we have in the United States and also in Europe, that there is a left and right, and there's something inherent to the left and right. There's something essential to it.
Good people are left, bad people are right.
Well, this is the essence of essentialism.
The victims are certainly on the right.
When you talk to people about
conservative,
like,
conservative tears, man.
What is the essence of conservative and progressive? Everybody ultimately, this is, let me like reveal the veil for you. Whatever team you're not is ultimately evil shitbags. That's the essence. That's the essence, is whatever team I'm on is insert good values.
Bad faith. Liars.
The other team, if you give them enough steroids, they're Hitler. That's it. And there's no real thing to it. There's no essential thing to it. And so it usually ends up being something like, okay, conservatives want the status quo and progressives want to change it. And then you start thinking about it and going, okay, Trump versus Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton was the conservative. No, okay, like it, because it, blue team and red team are grab bags. It's all changing. It's all a state of flux. And when we attempt to have these conversations of there's some essential thing throughout the time space continuum of like reactive versus progressive or something like that, it ends up just breaking apart very quickly. So I'm in agreement with you, Jen. When they try and say, you know, what does conservative progressive mean by that? You need to be very specific, and it's really going to work better and better when you're talking about one thing. Like, are we talking about family leave? Well, now we can have a pretty good, like, unispectral conversation about this, because you can just look at it and go, do they have family leave or not, right? Or are we talking about, like, are gender roles fluid or are they traditional? Something like that. But then when we get into, like, family leave, gender roles, and the, like, should men get... It becomes this big attempt to make everything part of one spectrum. There's just too many spectrums, and it doesn't end up making any sense.
Well, and the only reason I was even willing to engage in this conversation, not knowing what the fuck they were measuring, was because we were just seeing like a global trend of women agreeing on something, just agreeing-ish. So it's like, why would all women be in like one direction? But like the specifics of it, I'm not sure that this poll is telling us that we're now going to be divided amongst gender and the way we vote. And like, I think that's just reading too much. Like, nothing about this poll makes me afraid of anything societally. I think it's fine.
We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Home is where the emails are. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. It's time for the Andrew Heaton Sports Question of the Week. Heaton, when are you asking Jen for tickets?
All the time. Every morning around 7 a.m., I call Jen and I go, bitch, where are my tickets?
I would love that phone call.
And Jen says, oh, they're in the mail. And I'm like, bitch, am I going to have to strangle the bitch? And give me the tickets. I want those tickets. This is what I say. I go, okay, give me the tickets. I love tickets.
You
love L.A. so much, so It makes sense.
Yep, because the, you know...
You wrote a book about how much you hate L.A., but not, maybe now you'll have to put it in a new chapter now that you're going to be there
I did write a best-selling work of poetry called Los Angeles is Hideous, yeah. Poems of an Ugly City, which anybody new to the program should definitely get as a coffee table book. That being said, I remain a fastidious observer of the L.A. Rams.
Very close.
Well,
same stadium, but a different shade of blue. It'd be more powder blue.
This storm goddess really likes its mascot.
It's not the Patriots because they're up in New England.
I know,
which is far, far, far.
It's not a Raven because they're Baltimore. They are purple.
Yeah,
so it's a powder blue. LA thing. And they carpool? Like they share the stadium?
They share a stadium. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
They are.
It's not the Lightning. Because I know they're in LA
that's
now.
That's now.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Traitors.
Thanks, Bob Dole.
Left Brooklyn. Yeah. That, you know what? They're important
the
too.
The Chargers hired a brand new coach, making his return to the NFL sidelines after a stint in college.
So he went back to school? Like he went back no, and like he, went like he from, got
so he was he lost in the a bunch NFL, of games
and he's
was,
like, you know, maybe old Bert should get his real estate license. He went back to college.
He was a San Francisco 49ers coach.
Uh-huh.
And then he left to go coach his alma mater in Michigan.
Right.
And now he has returned to the NFL for the LA Chargers head coach.
We've talked about him.
Bill it was like Bill Bagman. Bagachek. Oh, it's not Bill Belichick because that guy's with New England.
I get the Patriots. I like that you know some Patriots.
Yeah, I know. No, he wasn't able to get a job. He did get fired, but he wasn't able to get a job.
Bill Belichick did? Because the New Englanders were talking to us about this last week.
Yeah, he got
do they
canned.
Know? It's going to really canned, break their hearts when they find out that Bill Belichick is.
He lost too much, and so New England turned its back on him.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not happy about it.
Yeah, so what's the name of this L.A. guy that...
He was the Michigan guy who won the championship.
The Wolverines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jim
Hardball. That's right. Jim Hardball. No, I remember this now. Jim Hardball. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go Chargers. That's you. Charge them up. AC/DC power.
So Jen's season tickets for the LA Chargers now. We'll have Jim Hardball on the sidelines.
You can come see Hardball with me in person.
Are you going out to LA for this?
Probably for at least Chargers Broncos.
Yeah, you have fun.
The gang's position on politicians in a nutshell, writes Jen, they are part of the problem, but they are also the solution. Justin, they should be hunted in the streets like dogs. Andrew, I agree with you both.
Andrew is change the incentive structure so that the rat fucks have to do the right thing.
And yeah. Ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
Fixing and the broken zoning. Primary system says, would it be better if we had a system where every district just had people who were running for the position of delegate and people voted for who they think would be a good delegate. And then we wait until the convention where the delegates decide who the nominee would be. This could reduce the cost of running for president because candidates could appeal to the delegates at the convention directly instead of having to run around in each state. Candidates could still campaign in states to get their message out, and the voters might expect to elect delegates on who they support. But this could allow for candidates with a good message and less recognizability and less resources to have a chance.
I think they're just describing the old system, aren't they? Like, didn't that used to be what you did? Is that they'd go, like, in the Democratic convention, all the Democratic heads would come together and decide FDR was their guy?
It's literally the exact system that we had before the primaries, which is why people were upset because it was just decided in a smoky back room, which is literally the theme of our YouTube set here, is the smoky back room. But yes, that did not allow for upstarts. In fact, the upstart who broke that system was JFK by utilizing the nascent primaries in 1960 to have too many delegates to negotiate around. But otherwise, it was just a popularity contest amongst the elite as to how things would happen.
I think this is a great idea if you pair it with very open, robust ballot access in the general. So like, I like the idea of there being strong parties that where the insiders make the decisions. I just don't want them to be gatekeepers for everybody else. So if people are going to get onto the ballot, and once we've now got five people on the ballot, then the Democratic Party, the Republican Party wants to get together and make a closed deal decision on who they endorse of those existing people on the ballot, that's fine. I just don't want the parties to function as gatekeepers for everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, even saying that this is the system we had in the past, this is the system that Republicans and Democrats had. They are private parties, so they are not a part of our system, and how they choose to run their primaries and the fact that they suck at it, like, that's because it's all privately done. It's not actually our system as Americans. It's their system.
For the record, my mom texted me over the weekend and said, let Jen know that I think she is totally right and the government is super fucked up.
I sent that
to Jen. Mm-hmm. I want to point out that Jen's dad texted her and said that he would pity kill me if I had no one else to do it. would the election process be better?
Our parents are so supportive.
To you?
My parents think this is a radio show.
My dad said that in support. By the way, because you
and that's what rates for support these days.
You know what
that's what rates for support. Don't worry, if Justin is so pathetic that nobody would kill him, I'll pull the trigger.
Around
support
every day around 7:45 a.m. Mr. Clark calls me and goes, "Bitch, do you have any tickets?" And I go, "I'm working on it, Clark."
Or the election process be better. Right. If all the states had primaries on the same date, like the first Tuesday in March, or if that is too radical, have a selection of 12 states start the process at the same time.
I would like it better than two teeny tiny states deciding for the whole country.
They don't. But
they did.
No, so they don't. They eliminated bad campaigns that spent a lot of money.
Yeah, I think one of the things I learned about going to Iowa and New Hampshire is I don't think either state's a kingmaker. I think that they're speed bumps. Iowa and New Hampshire knock out candidates, but they don't really select candidates, but they knock them out. I would be happy to, like,
it's the same thing. If at the end of the day you have one candidate left when you go to vote, like, no, it's over.
You start with five, you two of them get knocked out, you got three. There's a winnowing process as opposed to a selection process. I like the idea of shaking up which states kick this off. I think that that's a good idea of, you know, rather than Iowa, occasionally Nebraska does it, rather than New Hampshire, maybe Vermont. You know, there's 50 states. I like the idea of they're alternating. I don't like the idea of there being one big national primary day. And the reason I say that is if you want to have one big national primary day, the candidates that are going to do well are candidates that have lots of money for mass media advertising. Because if you're reaching the whole country, you're not doing it on foot as a candidate, you're doing it through mass media. Whereas if you're doing this piecemeal as we currently do it, you have a shot of being able to go do grassroots democracy and meet people in rooms and shake hands and do it based on your ability to interact with people.
By the way, that's the reason why Nikki Haley's going to leave this race. Nikki Haley's not going to leave this race because she came in third in Iowa or second in New Hampshire. She's going to leave this race because regardless of what happens in South Carolina, she's got to go do Super Tuesday, which is extraordinarily expensive, and there's not going to be as much money for her to do it. So I don't know. I feel like I'm a broken record with this. It will only if you want Jeb Bush's and Hillary Clinton's to be the only people to compete, then you want this situation. You want a gigantic every primary process to be one day in multiple states. That's what you get.
All of this is already on national media anyway. All of these debates, the reason we even know Vivek Ramaswamy's name is because it was all on
racist.
Whatever. I never learned his name because he was not a fucking candidate by the time I vote. Like, all of it was national. So, I mean, we can pretend that Iowa and New Hampshire, getting to meet them in pizza ranches really matters, but like, we all participate. Well, I mean, I avoided as much as I could, but for a year, we debated these candidates. They had debates on television. Like, it was all national anyway, so you might as well let all of us vote.
I mean,
we're going to just go around in circles.
Whatever. Campaigning Without Money says, how do you tell a prospective voter about your small title, or your small little get to know me event, especially if you're not already an incumbent? You need money. You need to pay for advertising. You could avoid the need for money only if you attempted a purely viral word of mouth campaign, which if you're going to even try it, probably better off starting several years beforehand to try and build up name recognition.
Okay.
Down Home Tips writes, Heaton, how would you cook a classic Oklahoma burger?
Put milk in it. I'd get a bunch of ground beef, add a little bit of milk. I like my burgers moist, and I want them red and maybe going to poison me with some sort of parasite. I like this is me personally. I do not like well-cooked beef. I don't like well-cooked anything. It's the top of the food chain. I shouldn't have to fucking chew. I want it to fall apart in my mouth with minimal effort.
Oh my God.
Apparently, an Oklahoma burger is the smash burger. What has become popular as the smash burger?
What's a smash burger?
So you have the beef, right? Uh-huh. And then you put like a ton of onions on top of it, like, and then you have like a big weighted thing that smashes it all down. So the onions cook down into kind of a patty. But there's like a chain smash burger, but it is a popular kind of way to cook a burger, which was apparently initially the Oklahoma burger.
You guys see that we're going to get the tallest building in America? You see those headlines?
No.
In Oklahoma?
Uh-huh. In Oklahoma Where? City. I think it's Chase Mason Bank or something is putting up the funds to build what will be the tallest building in the States. And presently, the hurdle is just getting the Oklahoma City Council to allow for the regulation to allow for a city that or a building that big. But given that the Oklahoma City Council is willing to throw a lot of money at stadiums and other things in order to bring revenue to the state, pretty sure they're going to be okay with it. And I can't fucking wait. I would love for Oklahoma City to have the tallest building in America. Yeah, make it big enough that I could see it from my house in Austin.
That's what Oklahoma needs. Its own Burj Khalifa. Like, it just needs a gigantic, just one huge building amongst the otherwise titanic skyline of Oklahoma City.
Yep.
Yeah.
Increase Congress writes, there is a movement out there built around something called the Wyoming Rule that addresses a lot of this, but often overlooked is that not only would increasing the size of the House increase representation on the micro level, but it would also inherently alleviate gerrymandering. It would automatically make the Electoral College more proportional, and it would help shrink the bloated administrative state by returning many of its functions to Congress.
I think this is a great idea. One of the problems that we have in our democracy that we spoke about, I think, last week was, excuse me, was that congressional districts are way too big. Trying to be a representative for 700,000 people is a very tall order. You're not going to be a responsive representative legislator for a group of people that size. Every other developed country has much smaller ratios, and all of those reasons are well put. People that are bothered by the unfair nature of the Electoral College, it becomes more balanced. Gerrymandering becomes harder, possible, but harder to do just because you've got fewer people to work with. I think it's a great idea. The tiny government guy would love to triple the size of Congress for this reason. I would have a much larger amount of people that are actively in Congress that would make for a more responsive democracy and alleviate a lot of these problems.
Heatonism from last week's show writes, Sarah Jessica Lawrence College.
I actually caught that in real time and kept my mouth shut.
Yes.
Is that not how you say it?
I have no idea. Well, hold on. What is it? Sarah Jessica Parker.
Oh, so Sarah Lawrence College. Yeah.
I think
yeah.
Sarah Jessica Lawrence College is funnier. I stand by that. It's a funnier way to say it.
You won't get this, but Jed might, but that sounds like a like Chris Berman highlight reel thing. Like if Chris Berman, who used to do the combination of names, I guess it's going to nobody. old pregnant woman tracker says geriatric pregnancy used to be called pregnancy in advanced maternal age, but was changed in part because advanced maternal age was perceived as insulting.
Geriatric is so much
bad
worse.
Choice.
That is some bad choice.
Passive aggressive doctor bullshit right there.
Was yeah.
Like, oh, you're offended by advanced maternal age. Fine. We'll call you geriatric. Fuck you. I'm a god.
I know. We're going to change geriatric. It's now going to be called dust production. Yeah. Surprise writes, Jen, so I saved the episode on surprise medical billing you did a while back. I really appreciate the episode. I had to go to urgent care for a minor issue, and they didn't have physical papers to even look at. It was a signature pad, and the guy behind the desk just read the title of the document he was attaching my signature to, including one on surprise billing, quote, in case we needed to do something out of network, end quote.
You know, it's I'm so glad that you caught that. And, you know, as I'm sitting here trying to get myself back into congressional dish, when I was having about a week, like, do I want to keep doing this? That episode kept coming to my head because it's just one of those things that had I not watched that hearing and not understood it, I've been told by my audience that they saved thousands of dollars by even being aware of surprise medical billing. So yeah, this makes me very happy. It makes me feel like my work matters because it's just one of those things that the Congress, they talk about things that affect our lives and legislate things that affect our lives in very real expensive ways. And that episode, I think, is one of the most important that I've ever done. So good catch, my friend. I'd be curious to know if you signed it after seeing that, if you even had a choice.
Well, if he writes back, I'll send it on.
Yeah.
On the Road writes, I would love to listen to a podcast that's just Andrew and Justin travelogue as they travel through Middle America. Imagine Heaton's boundless enthusiasm bouncing off Justin's cynical straight man persona as they discuss the merits of deep fried sandwiches. It's the content America needs.
We did a touch of that, although I won't be able to package it, where Justin was wonderful this last episode, not just in hanging out with me in New Hampshire and also chauffeuring me and letting me be sidekick to him, but also being able to kind of walk me through on making a travelogue episode that Justin's an expert at. And so we kind of got out of the habit of we would go to the Marianne Williamson event and then just start recording our thoughts on it. And,
yeah.
And so this could happen someday we'll be at some event and Justin and I will just be driving around.
We'll just drive. Maybe for the conventions, maybe we'll drive, you know, between, I don't know, Chicago and Milwaukee. It's not really much of a drive. We'd stop once for gas, maybe.
Although I got to say, though, I love this part.
I think
part
they're 3 weeks apart, though.
Well, then we can do donuts.
Yeah. Yeah. Won't come back. I do love that.
Really
bit about
burn
it.
Some gas.
I thought about the other day. I like most places I've been. Like it's yeah. kind of rare for me to go yeah. to a place and be like, this is a shithole. Like most places I've been to, I'm like, okay, New Hampshire, Iowa, very different. I love both of them. I think they're great.
I'm like you. I don't really, I always get a little squinty whenever somebody's like, oh, I went there. This place sucked. It was terrible. It's like, you're the guy who writes a bad Yelp review because the waitress was late.
Yeah.
And like you're, I don't believe you.
Yeah.
Like most places are pretty good. Some places are not all that. They're not electric. Yeah. They're not like the most exciting places on the planet. So I guess if you know you feel there's an expectation for some place to entertain you, then it won't. But in general, I don't know. Although it's nice.
I can't think of anywhere outside of Hobbs, New Mexico that I've hated.
Yeah, if America ever needs an enema, it should start with Los Angeles, in my opinion. But outside of that
for
one
Christ's
city,
sake.
I were
there during COVID. You don't know anything about
Los Angeles.
You're
right. It's a beautiful city when there's no pandemic going along. All those sunbaked cement blocks with gouged out eye holes. It's a beautiful place.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Is somebody that has traveled a lot, though. One of the things I have become very adept at is being able to understand when guidebooks can't say this is not a fun place to visit. So, like, they'll say, like, locals really make this place. And that's like, ah, then no one ever visits this place is what that means. Or, like, anytime you ever see Gateway to X, that means boring place that's not the thing you want to go
to. That's near blank.
Yeah. Gateway to the X means not the X.
Damn.
That's
shots
what that means.
Shots at St. Louis.
Sorry, St. Louis.
Shots at St. Louis. The rule of two brings us home. I know you guys don't do letters about letters because it will turn into letters about letters about letters. But on today's episode, a letter writer claimed that Jen's catchphrase was, "All politicians are shitheads that will let you down." That quote should be attributed to Catherine Mangu Ward, you know, the other female podcaster.
Well, thank you, because it certainly wasn't me.
We like to correct.
Jen is consistently in favor of politicians being shitheads that should not be given power.
No. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Heaton, what's up on the ORF?
Well, a couple of things. Since we didn't talk about this last week, maybe a month ago, I described the Trump ballot case getting knocked out in Colorado is inchoate to the umbrage of some of the listeners who've written in and challenged my assessment of inchoate. Listener, fucking hate it when you do this to me, where I go, God damn it, I'll read the fucking thing. So I read the fucking thing. I read the court case. I brought on an attorney friend. We talk about the court case. I still think it's a bad idea. I don't think I would have sided with the judges if I'd been a judge, but I will upgrade it from inchoate to cohate. It's gone from...
It is coherent.
It is a coherent argument that
although
I still disagree with.
I think that you were calling an emailer
inchoate. Oh, then I stand by that assessment.
You were not calling the argument inchoate.
So the two things, if you're curious as to the legal side of the attempts to remove Trump from the ballot, not the philosophical side, which we've largely talked about whether or not it's a good idea to remove a threat to democracy from the ballot, like the kind of ought, but rather the is, what is the actual thing that the courts are ruling on? That's something where myself and my friend Anna Gorish have gone through, read the decision. Anna concerned herself with how the Supreme Court's going to handle it. So if you're curious about the legal side of it, that's on the Political Orphanage, as well as a travelogue from New Hampshire, where I drive around and try and get an idea of what independents are like, how they operate in New Hampshire, and among other things. Justin and I, when we were there, got invited to hang out at the New Hampshire Libertarian Party's clubhouse. And
it was awesome.
We went there and had a kind but uncomfortable conversation where I was very questioning the tactics that they were using online.
Specifically, their Twitter account.
Their Twitter account.
If you are dialed in and we're talking to enough of an audience that might know by reputation the New Hampshire Libertarian Party's Twitter account, which has made a reputation for itself by, let's say, euphemistically, bare-knuckled content. Some might say aggressive asshole content that is there to spur engagements. We talked to not the person who runs it, but the person who is in charge of
party director or chair, I can't remember, but somebody that's running.
So, and I thought it was a really good conversation.
It was a really good conversation. Yeah. The whole conversation is going to be on the bonus episode this week, but I cut that down to maybe 20, 25 minutes. And like, it's a very like interesting way because I've got a whole lot, like a prohibitive amount of Mr. Rogers in me where I do not want to be mean to people. But they were very much taking the opinion that you need to.
Says the guy who called me a bitch 17 times on this episode.
You're not people. You're not a person.
We mean men.
Yeah,
come
you're
on.
Just a token.
Other men who count. But they were very articulately put forth their position that they are going to promote ideas by being very confrontational.
And they will attract attention through confrontation, and through that attention, they will talk about their actual ideals. Yeah. It is an interesting conversation, and I'm pumped to hear the portions that you air and whether or not I ruined it by my microphone going out in the middle of it.
Nope, it's fine. Yep, it wasn't a problem at all.
Jen, do we have anything on the radar?
Not right now,
but soon.
I think
TM.
So.
On PX3. We are covering politics, so go ahead and listen to that. Till then, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying, for Andrew Heaton and Jen Briney, I'm Justin Robert Young, and we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.